Finishly. It's not on time, leave early, right? By the way, I got to update the PowerPoints. I mean, the outlines, I know. Because I sliced it, and I didn't realize how much I had chopped off from the last time I updated it. But I will work on it, I promise. So we had a situation where the French came in, took over the country, and used it for exploitation. The extraction of resources to fuel the French economy. They did not allow the Vietnamese to be in the government. They did not give the Vietnamese people any type of rights or protections, civil protections. And as a result, it kind of angered the people. And unfortunately for the French, had they done it 100 years before, everything would have been a hunky-dory. But the problem was is they were trying to impose a colonialist system at the beginning of the 20th century, at a time when new ideas were circulating around the earth. And one of the most powerful ones that were taking root was nationalism. The Vietnamese people had never had a sense of national identity prior to the arrival of the French because they always were divided. They were always controlled either by the Nguyen, lords, or they were in separate kingdoms. But the one thing that they all had in common was now they were all controlled by the French, foreigners. And at the end of the day, they did not like that. So they embraced this new ideology, nationalism. Now, generally, when I read stuff, quotes, I don't expect students to write it down. This is going to be the exception. I'm going to give you a definition. Please add it to your notes. This is the best definition for nationalism that I found in all my years of teaching. Ironically, it was written by a Holy Cross professor. Because back in the day, do they still have the consortium? Do you have the ability to go take classes at other colleges? Yeah. I did that. I ended up my undergrad years at Worcester State. And most of my classes were actually at Clark or Holy Cross. So I paid Worcester State prices and I got those classes. But anyways, one of the professors there, and I had it in my notes when I was your age. And it was just perfect. Nationalism is a conscious bond. A conscious bond shared by a group of people. Nationalism is a conscious bond shared by a group of people who feel strongly attached to a particular land. Conscious bond shared by a group of people who feel strongly attached to a particular land and who possess a common culture and history marked by shared glories and sufferings. And who possess a common culture and history marked by shared glories and sufferings. Did you get it? This is just perfect. Because nationalism, it's not a blood thing. It's not a racial thing. It's a conscious bond. People identify themselves as part of a group.
And what brings them together? A particular place that they call home. But they've been there for a while together. They have things in common. Same language, same traditions. And they also have good times and bad. You know, it's the perfect definition. Everywhere on earth, there are groups of people that have this national identity. And ironically, the people responsible for creating this mindset that was articulated by political theorists and sociologists, ironically, it was the French. In the 19th century, France basically went to war with Europe, both during the wars of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, from basically 1790 all the way to 1815. Europe was at war against France. The French rallied their people over the love of their nation, and the people that had to deal with the French were rallied because they weren't the French. But the irony was true with all of them. They believed that their nation was the best, that they were chosen by God to win the war. Now, what's the difference? Well, previously the focus was localized. You may not know this, but throughout the bulk of history, a human being probably never went more than 10 miles from where they were born. So people used to identify not by countries, but rather they used to identify based on whatever village or town they lived in. So I was born and raised in Northbridge. I played football in Northbridge. We were the Northbridge Rams, and we used to kick the living snot out of everybody, especially Oxbridge, right next door. We used to kick the shit out of Douglas playing basketball. Why? Because we were the Northbridge Rams, and we were better. And you probably all felt the same way about your school system or your town when you were born and raised there. Well, prior again to the modern age, that's where you were born, that's where you were raised, that's where you would die. So you were proud of it, you loved it. But what started happening was the governments started expanding and the population cluster started growing. So it wasn't just the person in Northbridge or the person in Oxbridge or the person in Douglas. Suddenly it was the people in Worcester County. And then it might have been a little bigger. Maybe it was Western Mass or Central Mass. Or maybe eventually it would be in Mass. You know, so the more events happened, the more times changed, economies changed, circumstance changed, the focus of people started getting bigger and bigger. But by the Napoleonic Wars, people started identifying themselves based on their nation. The American War for Independence. 13 colonies rose up against the crown, overthrew that tyrant, King George III, and made America these United States thereof. People had pride. People loved it. It was great for the European Western civilization countries. The problem was this idea would eventually make it into the places where the Western European countries had taken control of. And lo and behold, the people in Vietnam started not just identifying by their villages, but soon they started saying, if we are in Annam, or we are in Tonkin, or we are in Cochin China, we're all the same. We're all the same people. And there is strength in numbers. Because truth be told, You wouldn't have anything you have if you lived in another country. Some places on Earth, by the time however old you are, you could have been dead already. No food, no hospitals, no medicines, no electricity, no running water. You know, don't forget, there's a reason why we're the only country on Earth that people die trying to get in. Most places on Earth, people die trying to leave. Because we've been able to keep ourselves together. Yes, we've had some rough times along the way. Not going to deny that. But at the end of the day, we're all in it together. And it's a cause worthy of sacrifice. That's the reason why there are men and women who willingly take the oath to serve and defend the country and are willing to die in God-forsaken corners of the earth for you to be here and listen to me babble. Nationalism. And nationalism became so big, people started even worrying about their religions. Because think about it. In America, does it matter if you're a Catholic or you're Episcopalian or a Presbyterian or a Baptist or a Buddhist or a Muslim? No, religion's not even important. It's us, America. Because in the end, we are stronger when we're together, and we are weaker when we're divided. And so in the end, nationalism does trump all as a motivating factor that leads to national success. So, the French are occupying Southeast Asia. They're denying the people access to prosperity. They're denying people access to due process of law, to rights. They're denying people access to make local governmental decisions. If you push and you push and you push and you push, eventually the group is going to sit back and say, hey, wait a minute. Why are you telling us what to do in our country? So it should be no surprise that at the beginning of the 20th century, nationalism would creep into Vietnam. Now, I used to have a whole unit prepared on how it got there, but there's no point in it. I'll just make it really simple. Just like it was the French who created the idea of nationalism through warfare, the French would also be responsible for allowing nationalism to get into Vietnam. Because under the French imperial system, if you were a citizen of the French Empire and you had enough money, you were allowed to go to France and study. So what happened was is kids of wealthy Vietnamese would get on a ship and would sail to France. And they would attend French universities. And they would be exposed to all of these European ideas. And they would bring them back home. And these ideas would eventually inspire the first person to stand up. Phan Bui Châu. By the way, most revolutionary leaders are not poor. Typically, they come from middle class or upper middle class families. And that was the case. He was the son of a scholar, a learned professor, an educator. But at the time, one of the popular philosophical views of Vietnam was Confucianism. Now, as a youth, Phan Bui Châu was prepared to follow in his father's footsteps. He went to the academy, he learned Confucianism. Because if he managed to graduate, he could get a government job. But the problem is by the time he was getting ready to graduate, France came in. And started shutting down those opportunities. So, when he couldn't get a job as a government agent, he decided to become an educator.
And soon, he taught, he began gathering a small group of students, and they started sharing books and pamphlets that were coming in from Europe, talking about all of these foreign political, ideological schools of thought. But he was living out in the villages, so he really couldn't have that big of an impact. But in 1900, he decides to move to the capital, Hue, and he began making contacts with people who were thinking the same idea. Why is it that we, this national group of people that have always lived here, are being subjugated by foreigners? Maybe we should engage in a self-strengthening movement and break away and win our independence. Well, how are you going to do it? The French, after all, conquered Vietnam through military force. They proved, even though they only had a few thousand soldiers in their military forces, they had superior firepower, they had superior tactics, and they can unleash a lethality that the Vietnamese could not resist. How could they do it? Well, Phan Boi Châu, he came up with a three-step plan. How do you build a group that can overthrow a regime? First, you gotta get a group of people together. You gotta organize. He began telling people of like-minded interests, let's pool our names, let's pool our resources, and let's start spreading the word. FYI, to make an analogy with the American War for Independence, it would not have happened for those Sons of Liberty, in which they soon began talking to one another in the different colonies. This is essentially the same first step. Organize, spread the message. You also have to make contacts among the wealthy Vietnam. The imperial dynasty was still there, the ruling family, but they had become puppets. So what the group needed to do is they needed to contact somebody in the royal family who could make this a national effort. Maybe you could make contacts with people who are the wealthy landlords that have money, or some of the merchants that are profiteering. Doing business with the French, but would rather be in business from themselves, make more profit. You gotta start getting the movers and shakers. And last but not least, you gotta get outside help. Foreign aid. In particular, most importantly, was the Japanese. But you also could get help from the Chinese as well. Anyone know why the Japanese?
Is it because at the time they were developing really fast and they were getting more they were very industrialized and they had more international power?
100%. Japanese were going through a period of time known as the Meiji Restoration. And the Japanese were able to do one thing that no other civilization on Earth was able to do. Not get conquered by the Europeans. And they did so by adapting.
They made friends with the Europeans. They embraced industrialism, modernization. By the beginning of the 20th century, the Japanese were actually recognized as a great power because they had a modern military, a modern navy, and they had the ability to conquer others in war. So these guys were the big dogs industrially, militarily in Asia. Although China had traditionally been the big dogs, but they also had the most people. So it was a foolproof plan. Perfect. And he started putting it in motion. He would actually form a revolutionary party. Du Tuan Hoi. Rings right off the tongue, doesn't it? FYI, that's the Modernization Association. Modernization Association. They were saying exactly where they stood politically. The only way to get independence for Vietnam is to stop having Vietnam be an agrarian economy whose culture is based in the 12th century. No, we need to embrace industrialism, modern economies, modern industrial processes, just like the Japanese. But in their propaganda, they were also anti-French and pro-independence. Their slogan was threefold. Defeat the French invaders, restore Vietnam, and establishment of government of and by the people. Everything was good. Money was coming in. Phong Boi Chau, he made a contact with a prince in the royal family who gave him connections and wealthy businessmen. They were printing newspapers. They were gathering disciples. Everything was growing great. And they would also hit the streets. In 1908, Duy Tan Hoi would inspire two actions of protest that essentially was going to get the ball rolling. You know, like the Boston Tea Party. Got to get the ball rolling to inspire independence. Oh, sorry, I thought I had the clicks, but I guess I don't. So go back. The first took place in early 1908. The French government agents began going around and collecting taxes. If you did not have the cash to pay your taxes, you would be taken and basically forced to engage in labor service to the state. Well, in many of the cities, protests erupted. Hundreds of demonstrators took to the streets, chanting slogans, waving banners, doing the same thing that happened during the Black Lives Matter protests. Well, unfortunately for them, the French were like, hell no. They unleashed the soldiers. Thousands of them were arrested. Some were executed. Others were deported to some of the penitentiary islands that they had in the South Pacific. Prison islands. Crashed! But it was the first move. Well, in retaliation for that, in the capital, a plan was hatched. Nationalists developed a plan. Okay, so we can't rise up everywhere in the country. Let's just focus on Hanoi, the old northern capital. What we will do is we will take out the army to stop them from shooting us. So, some of the local Vietnamese cooks who had been getting paid to make the meals for the French soldiers were basically bought off and were convinced to put poison in the food of the soldiers. Well, about 200 French soldiers got really, really, really sick, but not a single one died. They mixed in a datra, which is a leaf, like a flowery leaf that could be found in the North Vietnamese jungles, that if you take it, it doesn't smell, it doesn't really have a taste, but if you grind the leaves down once they're dried out, it just looks like oregano. So the cooks had never poisoned anyone, apparently, and so they just didn't put enough in. Well, nobody thought anything of it, because you ever gone to a restaurant and get food poisoning? Ever have an outbreak here? You know, one day, you know, some cook doesn't clean their hands, so everybody gets kind of sick. No, that would never happen here. McDonald's, maybe. Well, the French, okay, maybe it was just a bad batch of something. No big deal. Well, unfortunately, one of the chefs, who was a converted Catholic, went to confession. The priest then reported the confession to the government officials. And then the government freaked out. They would declare martial law in Hanoi, lock down the city, and began going house to house, found back channels, who were the cooks involved, who contacted the cooks? Where did they come from? And eventually, the plot leaders and the plotters themselves were arrested. 37 would get the death penalty. Death by guillotine. The rest were either kicked out, sent to exile, or they were in prison. This put the French on high alert. And all up and down the country, the French went into action. Swift, severe. Eventually, Chow's name was discovered. C-H-A-U, not O-U, typo. Chow was identified as being the leader of the group, and thus responsible for the plots. But luckily word got to him that the French knew who he was. So he would flee the country. He first went to Japan, hoping to make use of some of the Japanese contacts. But the Japanese are like, no, we're getting along with the French. We're not going to go to war with France over you. So he was then forced to flee to China. Well, all the while, French secret agents were in pursuit. And they would eventually track him down in Shanghai. They arrested him, and then, working with the Chinese officials, extradited him back to Vietnam. He was put on trial, found guilty, but because of his popularity, the French decided not to make a martyr of him. Instead, he would spend the rest of his life under house arrest. 1909 until his death in 1940. But without the leader, the movement basically began to evaporate. I can't give you an analogy in America, because all of the people that first started protesting when the British passed the Stamp Act, people like Benjamin Franklin, Patrick Henry, you know, they kind of remained in it for the long term. All right. 1910, things began to subside. Over the next decade, I could not find any proof of any type of nationalist activity in Vietnam. But something was happening on the global level that would kind of cause it to come back to the surface. That would be the war to end all wars. World War I. Don't have time to talk about it, But it truly was a global battle. I mean, a global conflict. There were battles all over Earth, and including in Asia, by the way. But it's not the war that caused the change. It's a visionary who emerged amongst the war that got the word out, the ideas. None other than President of these United States, Woodrow Wilson. During the last years of the First World War and during the peace process afterwards, Wilson would articulate a new world order, a new vision. And the most powerful component of his words, because it's words that inspire, was his belief in what would become known as self-determination. Which means what? Self-determination. Really? No clue? What does self mean? Yeah, you all determine. Not, I mean, okay, decide, right? It's not that hard. So, who should decide your fate? There you go. Any of you ever heard of the 14 points? That was a document, 14 points, on which Wilson believed the post-war world should be dealt with. Well, a lot of them had to do with what was going on in Europe. But point 5 had to deal with colonialism. And he said, and I quote, post-war, there would be a free, open-minded, an absolutely impartial adjustment of all colonial claims based upon strict observance of the principle that in determining all such questions of sovereignty, the interests of the populations concerned must have equal weight with the equitable government whose title is to be determined. Wilson, part of his vision for the post-war world was basically, look, let's talk to all of these colonies that are around the earth and let's see if we can change the lines, change the terms. What if the colony doesn't want to be a colony anymore? What if they want to be their own country? Well, we should work with them because everyone's entitled to freedom. Well, this was like throwing kerosene into a fire. All around the world, Wilson's words were heard and they inspired all different types of nationalist movements. The same was true in Vietnam. Oh, self-determination. I didn't realize I had it in there. Nhan Dan Phu is the top guy, and Phiang Nang is the bottom guy. Those were two of the most nationally, if you could say it nationally, recognized intellectuals. When they read Wilson's words, they began printing pamphlets basically saying, now is the time. You know, the first nationalist movement failed, but now is the time that we can work with the French, and the French will be responsive. And we can collaborate. But guess what the French told them? Go pound sand. So when efforts of words failed, By 1919, 1920, 1921, again, pamphlets began circulating, hinting at the desire to obtain a revolution. And it seems that many people in the north, Tonkin, and in the central part, Annam, they were game. And they began to organize. But nothing big, nothing national. They were all small little groups. The most prominent was the Vietnam Quoc Dan Dong, sometimes known as the VMQDD. This is the Vietnamese Nationalist Party. This was the first homegrown revolutionary group. They not only preached revolution, but they preached violence. They said the only way they can achieve independence is to basically cause terror to the French. Their goal was to spark a national revolution through militarism and overthrow the colonial system. Their aim? A democratic socialist state. This group was large enough, it had cells in many parts of the country, that they also worked with similar groups in Laos and Cambodia. So all through this French Indochina, the five separate zones all kind of being collectively governed as one, these little cells were popping up. And people in these countries were like, look, we don't want to be French colonists anymore. They've managed to get converts in the army. Soldiers, Vietnamese soldiers who volunteered to serve in the National Army. Some of them converted. Teachers converted. Western educated young converted. But you know what they weren't able to do? Talk to the peasants. So you had the leadership, you had the foot soldiers, but you didn't have the support of the people. Now here's the funny thing. Any of you ever heard of Mao Zedong before? He's the Chinese communist who overthrew the Chinese nationalist government and created the Communist People's Republic of China. Mao Zedong once said that the people are like the water in a stream. They can help a boat safely cross the river, or they can capsize it. The movements that are successful, they recognize the importance of getting the people to support the cause. The mistake that the Vietnam Quoc Dan Dong made was that they did not even try to reach out to the people. So as a result, it was doomed to fail. And proof came in the one significant action that they engaged in. February 9th and 10th, 1930. The converted troops in one garrison in Tonkin rose up and killed their officers. This is known as the Yen Bai Mutiny. Now, you need to know this for the exam. And why is it called the Yen Bai Mutiny? Because they were in the village of Yen Bai. Well, 40 soldiers, Vietnamese soldiers, opened the gates and allowed another 60 civilians, members of the party, to enter the base. And they would attack the 29 French officers in charge of the base. French didn't see it coming. Five were killed, three were seriously wounded. But because the party members didn't speak to everybody, the only people involved were the soldiers who had been members of the cause. The remaining 550 Vietnamese soldiers that were not part of the group got up their guns and killed the party members and crushed the mutiny. Anyone caught that was a participant, they were rounded up and killed by firing squad. And then the French went military base, military base. Went through all of the roles, and they would basically identify many of the people that were part of this group. And in the end, just like the first go around, the VNQDD would be short-lived. Most of the survivors would flee, and they would end up in China. So, you had one group before World War I, inspired, tried, failed. You had another group in Vietnam, post-World War I, inspired, tried, failed. But there would be one who would come forward that would succeed. The most important Vietnamese nationalist, Ho Chi Minh. Now, most historians agree that Ho Chi Minh is one of the great revolutionary leaders of the 20th century. And why is that? He didn't die. He was able to spearhead a revolutionary movement, overthrow the French, defeat the Americans, and give rise to an independent state, the modern country of Vietnam. But if you would have met him at any point throughout most of his life, you would never know what he would do. Because he was born like you and I. He was born in the countryside, rural community, May 19th, 1890. He came from a lower middle class family. And had a simple beginning. But Ho Chi Minh is not actually his name. His birth name is Nguyen Sinh Khong. His parents, his father was a poor scholar. He was raised in the village of Kim Lien, where if you go to Vietnam today, they have a national museum there. He went the path that his family was fortunate enough to provide for him. Most kids didn't go to school, but because his dad was an intellectual, like a small teacher, he was able to get him into school, and he went to what was called grammar school, which was the equivalent of high school. Apparently, he was pretty academically strong, maybe not gifted, but he did well in school. So much so that upon graduation, he actually received an apprenticeship and gained admission to a technical school, which is the equivalent of a college. He stayed there in Saigon for a few years, but then he didn't finish. Something happened. We don't know. But we do know in 1911, at the age of 21, he basically decided, I'm leaving. He would leave Vietnam, his country of birth, and he would not return for 30 years. He got a fake identity because you were not allowed to permanently leave Vietnam. The fake identity identified him as a guy by the name of Ba, who was born in China, according to the papers, And he would spend 3 years working as a cook on the ship, on which he got on board. He visited Africa. He visited America, including Boston and New York City. He then, once he did his 3-year stint on the ship, he would live in London for 2 years, working as a pastry chef. And then he would move to Paris, where he spent 6 years, basically getting any work he could to afford his flat. Apparently he was a gardener, he was a street sweeper, he was a waiter, a photo retoucher. He even got a job as an oven stoker in some of the bread factories. He needed someone who would constantly keep the fires going. He did all kinds of odd jobs. But it was in Paris that he was exposed to another idea. Marxist-Leninist thought. This would make a significant change than the other nationalist movements. Any of you know anything about Marxism or Leninism? Okay, what do you got?
Karl Marx believed that you should, like, the people were entitled to, like, the fruits of their labor, basically, and that, like, there'd be no, like, monopolies or, like, big companies that would, like, make all the money. The money would go to the people.
Anything about Leninism?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Mm-hmm. The core of both is the concept of socialism. Marxism and Leninism built upon a foundation of socialism. And, should be no surprise, like many isms, it also began in France. The first socialists were alarmed by the values that came out of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. Because one of the things that was being pushed was individual economic freedom, known as laissez-faire economics, in which the government would have no control over the economy. Hands free. So, as these nations industrialized, that meant people would be free to make as much profit as imaginable. But here's the thing. Capitalism, by the way, is the greatest economic system ever to materialize, because it has freed more people from poverty in human history than any other economic system. But the problem is that capitalism does foster inequality, because there are the people that own the businesses that make the money, and then there are the people that work for the businesses who get paid a portion of what the owner wants to give them. Capitalism also is really motivated by individualism, borderlining on selfishness. Because in the capitalist economy, you're allowed to get as much as you can get, so long as you're willing to work for it. But what about the people who lose? Capitalism does not provide a safety net. If you fail, that's your fault. So, the first socialists were people basically saying, yeah, maybe we need to have a safety net of sorts. Maybe we need to focus less on individualism and greed and focus on cooperation. You know, maybe instead of focusing on profit incentives, maybe we should focus on a sense of community. And the end, their focus was helping the poor. Because they didn't think it was right that there were rich people and there were poor people. But who is going to do this? Who is going to create this safety net? Who is going to help the poor? Well, the socialists called for the government to do it. And that is the heart of socialism. It's not a free economy. It's a controlled, regulated economy, where the government has the authority to set wages, to fix prices, to remove private property, and have state or community ownership of everything. Basically, it removes the you and me and gives us the we. Now, there were many, many early philosophers that would write books that would be influential and still influence people around the world. One of the earliest writers who called for this social reorganization was Henri de Saint-Saëns. But here's the thing. The language that he used is key to one of the reasons why I disagree. He argued that the government should be given full power to control all life in the country. So the government should be able to determine where you live. The government should determine what job you had. The government should determine what you get paid. The government should determine what you pay. Everything should be controlled by the government. And it has to be done by force. Because according to Saint-Saëns, there were parasites in the society, which at the time were like nobles, lawyers, the church. He basically said they should be stripped of everything, and that should be given to the poor people. And by the way, those parasites should have no say in government either. He said government should be controlled by the doers. And who were the doers? Well, the scientists, the intellectuals. Because the doers know how to do things, and they would plan an economy. And they would guide it forward and help the conditions of the poor. Okay? That's the system that our government has right now. But there were some that really, really went over the deep end. Like Charles Fourier. He called for the creation of a utopia. Self-sufficient communities like pods, in which the workers would be paid equal to what they contribute to the whole. Wages also would be determined based upon jobs. But what jobs would you get? Well, you would get whatever jobs you were interested in. Now, obviously, there are some pretty shitty jobs out there that no one would want. Well, Fourier argued that because they're so shitty, and I'm not saying that to be, oh, he's saying potty language. No, literally, there were people who had to clean the shit pipes out, had to sweep the shit from the animals off the streets. Real shitty jobs. Well, he basically said if the jobs could not be filled, you pay them more. Because the people who had the good jobs would be willing to give extra money to the people working the shitty jobs. But there would be no choice. Once you got a job, you were stuck with it. He also called for the destruction of the traditional family. He did call for the emancipation of women, but he called for the abolition of marriage, and he said there should be no monogamy, and he said that people should basically be able to have orgies if they were so inclined and have true sexual freedom. Well, what about all the little bambinos? Well, the government would take care of them as well, because the government would have full control over the children once they were born. So they would liberate the mother from the child, and the state would raise the child and instill upon that child state values. It's crazy stuff. Well, this idea of state control of the planned economy pretty much remained in France. It didn't travel out until the 1840s. And it began to expand globally. Thanks to a German intellectual who would add an additional series of layers to socialism. And that would be the means of achieving socialism. And that's what we call Marxism. Now, one of the things that I get a laugh out of, and again, I know we don't really have a big economics department here, but one of the other colleges that I used to teach at did. And the chair of the economics department was an actual Marxist. And he completely believed in Marx's theory. And the one thing that he could never counter me on was the fact that Karl Marx never actually worked a day in his life. He never had a job. He was a loser. Yes, he went to college, but he never got good grades. He could never find work. So what did he decide to do? He decided to write a book. But he didn't have the money to write a book. So he had to hook up with a classmate who happened to be the son of a rich businessman, Friedrich Engels. But for Friedrich Engels' money, you never would have heard of Karl Marx. Because he was not capable of achieving his own success. But, regardless, fueled by the fact that he was one of life's losers, and with Daddy Warbucks here bringing home the coinage, they would work together and they would produce a book known as the Communist Manifesto, which was first published in 1848. The manifesto is the guiding text on how to achieve socialism. According to Marx and Engels, society is based on materialism. Meaning, there's no intrinsic value to a human being in their unique characteristics, their emotions, their dreams, their desires. Marxism rejects that completely. Instead, people are defined by their jobs, not their souls, their jobs. So you are what you do. They judged some jobs to be important, but others wasteful. They also argued that work, labor, is the effort to change nature for profit. So, you want to have a business and then you want to be a restaurant? Well, you have to go get those items that come from agriculture and you have to transform that into something of value. And of course, in doing so, you have to use labor. But the problem is that the people who do the work don't get the bulk of the pay. Because most people have jobs where they work for somebody. They're not self-employed. The phrases that they used were French phrases. The bourgeoisie. A phrase commonly referred to those who had property. Marx and Engels always referred to them as the people who have. But there also was the majority of the people who were labeled as the proletariat. Any of you ever take Latin? Take Latin? You know how to dissect words to get to the root? The Latin origin?
Yeah, I just want to remember all of
them. Alright, well I won't put that much pressure on you, Aaron. But prole, do you ever learn the Latin word prole?
I don't think we learned that.
Isn't it like before or like
Alright. Prole was a word that the Romans used to refer to the poorest of the poor in society. They weren't plebeians. Plebeians was the commoners, the citizens, who small farmers, soldiers, owned the businesses, common class. Of course, they were the patricians, and they were the noble wealth. The proles were subhumans. Because the proles could only contribute one thing to society. The Latin word prole means baby. Because what do poor actually contribute to society? More kids. They don't own the businesses. They don't control the economy. They have nothing. Well, truth be told, the proletariat are often the ones in the factories that are doing the work on behalf of the bourgeoisie. But the bourgeoisie own everything, even though they don't do work. The proletariat, they don't own anything, but they have to work for the proletariat. In fact, they're the ones doing the labor, thus they're the ones who are generating the money for the bourgeoisie. Now, this was not new, according to Karl Marx. He, in the Communist Manifesto, in his other writings, talked that throughout all human civilization, there's always been the haves and the have-nots. If you go back to the ancient Greco-Roman times, you had the aristocracy who owned the land, and then you had the serfs or the peasants that worked the land. This relationship, this dichotomy is still the same in a commercial industrialized society. Just as the nobles exploited the peasants, well, the factory owners exploit the factory workers. But in that system is the seeds of its own destruction. Because every society produces things that could create the next society. Plant grows, takes nutrients out of the soil, grows bigger, grows healthier, and eventually drops some seeds. Most of the seeds are going to die. They're not going to take root, but some will. And the moment they take root, they will start sucking the nutrients out of the soil. And in doing so, it deprives the mother plant of the nutrients it needs to survive, killing it. Thus, replacing it with a new plant. The circle of life. Well, Marx argued The same is true in capitalism. Labor is the value, but the employer profits from it. The worker is separated from the fruits of its own labor. In essence, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But eventually, the owner, motivated by profit, will reduce the wages so low that the workers who do the things will rise up. Revolt. Overthrow the bourgeoisie. Seize control of the means of production. And if properly educated, it will share that property equally amongst the classless society. Thus, creating a new society. But here's the dirty little rub, and this will be the last thing of the day, and we'll do Leninism when we come back on Thursday. Marx was wrong because he's an idiot. My GPA was actually higher than his, significantly. The core of Marx's prediction is that a factory will essentially produce a single commodity. And because the owner wants profit, he'll oversaturate the market, thereby supply and demand, causing the prices to plummet when it's no longer profitable. And thus, will kill the business. How is Ford Motor Corp still open after 120 odd years? General Motors, General Electric, Apple, Microsoft. How are those companies still open after so many years? Do they continue to produce the same product over and over and over again? What do?
They innovate.
They innovate. They change. They make new products. Have any of you been stupid enough to sleep out overnight when the new iPhone is going to be sold? Fighting crowds to get the latest, almost upgraded model? You know there are people who do that, right? These companies have us all locked in to getting the next new, flashy, shiny model. Marx was right. People are greedy. But he missed out on the fact that our greed is going to allow for innovation that's going to cause for the company to continue to grow. So in the end, he predicted all of Europe would be socialist by 1900. They are socialist, but not to the level of almost being communist. So it just goes to show you that some ideas may sound good, but they don't actually work. But Lenin would figure out a way to make it work. And we'll deal with that on Thursday. Questions? All right, topics are due on Friday for your papers. If you haven't sent it to me, don't forget. And by the way, who are you, sir?
Jake.
Have you been here before?
No, sir. Today is my first year.
Where have you been?
Sick.
Oh. Do you know anyone in the class?
I don't know anybody at this class with me.
You don't know anybody?
I know now.
Oh, all right. Everyone else can go. You're good. I got to give you a website so you can catch up. Because you've already missed three classes.
I can text them.
Oh, you can help them?
Yeah.
All right, hook them up with the website, show them the lectures, show them how to get the notes and how to get the book. What book is needed, rather? By the way, did anyone get the book in yet? Did you buy it?
It's
Did it come in?
It's coming on Amazon.
Is it? Cool. How much you pay for it?
Like $15, not even.
$15?
About.
Not great. Did you get the hardcover?
I don't know.
You might get the hardcover, the new edition.
Yeah. Have a good one.
All right, we'll see you.
I grew up much of it. It's a different edition.
All right, well, the good news is I record all my classes. So on my website,